Yes, welcome to the Tech Talk with Hawk segment of the Synthetic Zen Show. We'll start out with this segment, then get into the normal music segment, although I'm so addicted to music, I gotta be playing something, so I'm gonna be doing a little Klaus Schulze in the background here. This is from his Contemporary Works number 1 album. It's 10 CDs. This is CD number 3, Wanfried Trance for Motion. So, in case you haven't caught the last couple of shows and not familiar with what Tech Talk with Hawk is about, let me fill you in just a little bit about it. I talk about technology and how it affects people's privacy and security, and what sort of laws and civil rights issues are occurring related to technology. Some topics would be like the DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, peer-to-peer file sharing issues, technology innovation, and the chilling effects of patents and abusive lawsuits, etc., on technology. Also, alternative technologies out there to the mainstream, such as alternatives to Microsoft and Mac OS X, etc., open source approaches to things, and ways to keep your privacy and security, your identity a little bit safer. Also, thinking about, like I said, this is a pretty new show. I just started doing it a couple of weeks back. I started with an OpenBSD show, and then during the pledge drive the week before, I did a two-hour special show on Friday from 10 to noon, and I had such a response from that. I had more responses from that single show than I've had from all my other shows combined. And then my original proposition for the Synthetic Zen Show was I'd spend about 15 minutes on something related to Tech Talk with Hawk, but it looks like I might be able to spin it off as a separate show, and we'll see, pending approval. So a few things here. I'm going to cover some of the recent headlines from EFF.org. That's the Electronic Frontier Foundation. They're a non-profit group out there of lawyers and paralegals, etc., who are out there fighting for your digital rights. And they're doing everything they can to help people out, not just and not have people just get trampled under the many abuses from government and large corporations, etc., related to technology and privacy. So here's a few of the headlines. I'm just going to skim through them, and then I'll get into some other topics from other locations, and then I'll try to cover a topic and then get into the regular music that you're used to hearing on the Synthetic Zen Show from all over the world. EFF to fight against spying case delays in Friday hearing. On Friday, November 17th at 10:30 a.m., a federal judge in San Francisco will consider the next step in EFF's class action lawsuit against AT&T, and they're handing over all the phone records, etc. EFF asks Supreme Court to tackle secret law. The Electronic Frontier Foundation and a coalition of nonprofit organizations asked the U.S. Supreme Court Monday to hear a case challenging a secret law governing travelers in American airports. I'd have to see a little bit more about that one. The case centers on the Transportation Security Agency requirement that travelers show identification before boarding commercial aircraft. So far, the TSA has refused to disclose the terms of the identification requirement to the public, claiming that they are sensitive security information, quote unquote. In the amicus brief urging the Supreme Court to hear Gilmore versus Gonzalez, EFF demonstrates that Congress never intended agencies to have unfettered discretion to impose requirements upon the public without allowing the public to review them. The TSA is allowed to withhold some information from the public, but only in cases where transportation security is at a risk. So they're saying security shouldn't be a magic password allowing the government to escape all accountability. And so then, that's interesting, but not quite along the lines we're looking here for. And let's see, a few of these others I already read to you the previous week. Courts did grant an appeal in the AT&T spying case, and that's still pending. All right, looks like we've covered the rest of it. Another interesting thing I stumbled across today, this is a little bit older news, but I just didn't hear about this, I guess because I'm not a big MySpace fan the way that, certain sites become very popular for a while, they get sort of a fad, and I'm not saying that MySpace is going to die or anything like that. I mean, there's some great usefulness there for everybody there. I guess I don't quite get the cultural aspect of it because the technology's been there for years and years and years. I've done it with many websites myself, but somehow it's had an interesting conglomeration there. And I guess maybe more broadband coming along has helped make such sites more viable. I was doing similar sites back in the late 90s, and people didn't really have that kind of capacity for video and such. But this is, for anybody who goes to MySpace, something to watch out for, and just another reason to consider alternate browsers, alternate operating systems, and being a little extra cautious when you're out on the web, especially when it comes to multimedia and allowing special programs like Macromedia that can have, unfortunately, a lot of security issues and vulnerabilities. More than 1 million MySpace users could have been caught out by a banner advertisement that installs spyware via a Windows bug. Now, this only applied to people who didn't have a certain update available from Windows, but a lot of people don't have those updates. So those who fell victim were bombarded with pop-up advertisements and had their net browsing habits monitored by malicious software. Let's see. Now, I was reading about this from a different article. This is from the BBC News website at news.bbc.co.uk. And it only affected people Internet Explorer browsers that didn't have the patch against the Windows Metafile bug, which was discovered in January 2006, and a few months later, update was available, but there's still a lot of people who don't get those updates. And I'm looking for, here we go, here's, it was a criminal act, says Hernanchu Nigam, MySpace chief security officer. This ad is being delivered by ad networks who distribute these ads to over 1,000 sites across the internet in addition to ours. We're working to have these ad networks remove this, so that they do not appear on our site. And so this was a company that had already been doing a lot of advertising and such, and somehow they ended up putting the spyware in here, so there could be all sorts of consequences to that later on. This was reported about July of this year, so that's a little something to be aware of, just to watch out for some of those things. I know a lot of people are really liking MySpace, but when you... there's always a trade-off between convenience and security, and that's just one example there of things to watch out for. Now, fortunately, Mac and Linux and BSD users were completely immune to that. And of course, if you did have your system up to date, then that's great. Let's see, I'm going to swing on over to Slashdot, news for nerds, stuff that matters. That's the little subtitle for their site. Slashdot has all sorts of different technology things. They cover video games and open source software and many other things. Looks like Australia is getting some new intense anti-piracy laws. Let's see what else here. The RIAA, Recording Industry Association of America. I can go on for hours just talking about the RIAA and how they've sued dead people and little old ladies and little children for supposedly making it a peer-to-peer sharing, hip-hop music, etc. A lot of these people, what happens is either their system gets infected unbeknownst to them and becomes a peer-to-peer file sharer and they don't know that they're sharing files, or if they're on a wireless network, someone hijacks their wireless network when they're not around and they don't realize that someone else is using their network, or if they're more advanced, they'll do a denial of service attack, knock the other person off, take the IP, and it seems like the other person's It seems like the original person is doing the violation when it's actually somebody else. There's a whole slew of reasons. And unfortunately, the RIAA and the MPAA, Motion Picture Association of America, they pretty much just go by IP address and then send out all these lawsuits for saying that you're a pirate, etc., and you owe $150,000 for all these songs that were downloaded or uploaded, etc. And they keep getting slapped on the wrist by the courts for violating due process and a lot of other, for example, they would file a lawsuit against 1,000 people, 1,000 John Does all at once, and this went on for a couple of years, and then finally the court said, hey, wait a minute, you can't do this, you have to charge one person at a time and hear each case individually, you can't keep doing this in a reverse, kind of the reverse of a class action lawsuit. More recently, last year, they started paying security companies to hack into users' computers to try to get personally identifiable information and to verify that indeed it's the computer that they're going after and who you are, so that they can then come after you more readily on peer-to-peer file sharing. Some of you remember Napster and Grokster and all these others. That's peer-to-peer file sharing. One woman in Oregon in October of last year filed a counter lawsuit on 50 different counts of violations of various laws because of these acts, especially since the types of music that were supposedly she was supposed to be downloading, she did not have on her computer, and even though, but they hacked into her computer to try to verify this. So that's a wonderful thing. So far, I haven't seen that case go anywhere, so I'm wondering if that just ended up settling out of court. I'm trying to find an update on it. Additionally, of course, I mentioned this last week, the Sony BMG issue with about 22 million Sony BMG and similar labels of audio CDs. These are the CDs you go buy at the normal store. And you can play them in a normal audio player, but if you put them in your PC, they install software and they install a backdoor Trojan that makes it so that Sony and company can remotely monitor and access your computer as administrator. And Sony thinks that's a great idea. Anybody who's even remotely concerned about privacy or security should be quite upset about that. But worse than that, there is a bug in their program that unfortunately opens up that root administrative access to any hacker who wants to. So it opened up millions of people's computers, and the antivirus doesn't detect it, or didn't at the time. So that was the Sony BMG and a few of their other albums in the last year and a half, 22 million records, or CDs, excuse me. If you put that in your computer, it will install that back door and open your computer up. Now, there was a big lawsuit about that, and Sony's come back with a patch, but no removal tool to get the Trojan off your computer. They just have a patch that supposedly will fix it from being hacked, but I think it's the second or third patch, because the first one came out, still didn't fix all the bugs, and so it was still hackable. So these are just give you a brief overview of a lot of the things going on. I think I'm trying to pick a specific topic to wrap up for tonight before I go fully into music. And there's so much going on here, it's sometimes hard to decide which. I'll tell you a little bit about another magazine I like to get sources from. It's called 2600. It's the Hacker Quarterly. Now, that does, unfortunately, hacker has gotten a really terrible connotation from what it originally meant. Hacker now means the same, is synonymous with computer criminal. And the original terminology came back from the 60s and 70s days of hacking on, or of programming on mainframes, like the old digital PDPs and such, with the paper tape feeds and the card punches, etc. Some people might remember that. And memory was extremely tight. You had very little memory available on these machines. And of course, they're ancient little processors. You know, we were measuring things in kilohertz, just barely getting into the megahertz range, let alone the where we're now in the gigahertz range. And so when people wrote code, the idea was to try to make it as lean, mean, efficient as possible, make it run as fast as possible, and keep the code as lean as possible so it's not bloated, so it wouldn't use up any more memory than was absolutely necessary. Every byte made a difference. Every bit made a difference. And so they would literally just keep hacking away at the code, taking out what wasn't necessary until it was as lean and mean as it could get. And so that was hacking at the code, and anybody who was really good at that was a hacker. Some of these key people were some of the founders of Apple and many other companies in later years. So that was the original meaning of a hacker, was somebody who, well, there were two types. There was a person who did it specifically on computers like that, or you modified technology in whatever way. If you took a record player and modified it some way to do something, I don't know, use it as a spinning wheel for a clay pot, or, you know, to make clay cups or something. what you're doing is you're modifying, you're hacking away at it. And so the other term for a hacker was somebody who just modified technology to use it in a way that it was not originally intended. But there was no maliciousness involved in any way. There'd be a lot of curiosity, and certainly the challenge prospect of it, but there was never any criminal intent. But unfortunately, somewhere, and I don't know if it was because of the movie War Games around 80-81 or so, or what happened, but the term quickly became pejorative rather than a compliment. So, meanwhile, there were people who were computer criminals and hackers now in the bad sense of the word. And one of these things they did back in the 60s and 70s was something called phone phreaking. And phone phreaking was you would simulate the drop of coins. You'd make a sound. This is back in the old analog days of the phones. You could make a sound of the headset that would trick the phone booth into thinking that you dropped a bunch of quarters in, and you can make calls anywhere you wanted doing that. And this was called a blue box. It was just a little box that was put together that made the tones that would simulate that, and that was around for many, many years until the phone companies became a little more wise to it and started to change how the system worked. But that was very gradual. It took decades. And so the frequency that was required to simulate that was 2600 hertz. And so that's where this magazine, 2600, the Hacker Quarterly, gets its original name from. It's been around a long time. I think it's been around, not quite sure how long, but it's probably coming up on 20 years. I should really find out exactly how long. And I've been subscribing to them for many years, on and off. And there is quite the element there. They also have a little radio show out in New York. And they've had some interesting run-ins with the government in protest of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Frequently I've worn a t-shirt here that's in defiance of the DMCA related to the DECSS, that's the encryption on DVDs. And what happened in the 90s was just before DVDs were released, I think it was a week or 2 weeks before DVDs were released, people knew that there was going to be copy protection on the DVDs. And some Northern European hacker person managed to hack the encryption 2 weeks before the DVDs were released to the public. So the copy protection was already void, and they'd already just decided they were going to stick to that encryption, and they're still using it to this day, the same encryption process, basically. But what it does is it's part of what limits your ability first of all, to copy is their primary purpose, but also to play it in different DVDs. You have to have the right zone setting, and then everybody has to pay for the hardware to decrypt these DVDs to make these DVD players. And so it makes the cost of all of it go a little higher too, and the complexity of it. Well, meanwhile, if you wanted to watch a DVD on your computer, initially you were just out of luck no matter what platform you were on, whether it was Windows, Mac, or Linux. Windows shortly thereafter had support, and then left that Mac, but Linux and BSD and other users were being left in the cold because they didn't want to license it to any of the open source companies, because that would mean they'd have to open source it. So DECSS kept floating around. You could download it and install it on any computer that you wanted to be able to watch DVDs. Otherwise, you couldn't watch any of the encrypted DVDs, which was the majority of them. Now, unfortunately, a byproduct of having that decryption is that it did mean you could copy the DVDs if you so chose, because once you decrypt it, you could do what you wanted with the data on there. So with the passing of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, I think it was in 98, original copyright law says you have a right to keep a backup archive copy of your intellectual property. The DMCA says, sure, you still have the right as long as you're not bypassing any copy protection. So you get into a little bit of a quandary here of, well, wait a minute, I want to make a backup of my DVD. You know how easily they scratch and crack and break and get ruined. I'd rather play a copy of my DVD than the original, so the original I can just keep in storage and only bring out when I need to make a new copy when my copy gets worn out. And unfortunately, that's now a criminal act to do so, to make that archive copy, because of the DMCA. So a lot of people just were saying, well, forget it, we're going to do it anyway. And you could download it on many sites all over. Well, then they started cracking down on any site that provided the DECSS software. That's the software you could use to bypass the CSS encryption on the DVDs. And so after they did that initially in the United States and wherever they had influence, then they went after any sites that linked to any other sites in the world. So in other words, if you had a website and you didn't have the file on your computer, but you're saying, hey, here's another website that does have it over in Romania or something, and you linked to Romania's server, they would come after you as providing information to bypass the copy protection, and you were in violation of the DMCA. And so a lot of sites were getting harassed and shut down over that. Well, one that really fought it was 2600 Magazine at 2600.com. They kept their links up there, so they were served by the federal courts and told to take it down. And so they had to go through the whole court process, and they went through multiple appeals. Meanwhile, they did T-shirts that had the actual algorithm of the CSS decryption algorithm on the T-shirts. They were selling those, and I bought one of those at the time in protest is what was going on. And I always get a lot of comments when I wear that shirt because it's quite a little interesting algorithm design on there. So, unfortunately, 2600 eventually lost the fight to keep the links up. But in recent years, the efforts to stop the linking seem to have all but disappeared. And basically, you can get the DECSS quite easily through a number of sites now. But unfortunately, you can't bundle DECSS with any product. So, for example, Linux or BSD, etc. You still can't play DVDs until you go download and install this file. It's pretty easy to do now. It's not a big ordeal the way it used to be. You used to have to compile source code, which isn't that big a deal, but for the average user it was. So the battle's kind of mellowed a little bit, but it's still going on, and it's just a little something to be aware of what's going on out there. And 2600 was at the front of that. So I have a bunch of their magazines here, and I'm just kind of thumbing through for content. One of them has a picture of wireless coverage in a metropolitan area and which ones are encrypted and decrypted. So a lot of you out there are probably now familiar with Wi-Fi 802.11b, 802.11g, 802.11, blah, 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 blah. And it's what lets you be on the internet wirelessly, so you don't have to plug in that pesky network cable. Whether you're walking around in Spokane on the hot zone here where you can be online for 2 hours, or your local college or coffee shop or Starbucks or any of these places, well, Wi-Fi is everywhere now. Or you have it at home. You know, you have your cable network, but you want to be able to have your laptop be connected while you're outside or downstairs or whatever. There's wireless everywhere. I actually, one of my companies that I had before I sold it off was a wireless ISP. We were doing prototypes of wireless towers for rural areas that were self-sustained with solar and wind power. So they were completely off the grid, and you could basically buy one of these towers from us, set it up, and cover up. The best range we had for a single tower was 8 miles by 12 miles at about 1 megabit of bandwidth. And then you could repoint it to a central office to have whatever backbone you wanted. And this was 2002 or so, and we had a lot of challenges to overcome because we were in areas where the weather was really nasty in the summer. It was extremely hot, 112 degrees plus in the summer, and then in the winters it was 20 below and 3 feet of snow. So it was a real challenge, but we did manage to work out the technology challenges of it. And that was years ago. Now you're seeing wireless ISPs popping up all over. It was a really neat thing. So I'm intimately familiar with the Wi-Fi technology. And also the mistakes a lot of people make. Most people, now luckily the newer Wi-Fi access points, APs, that people are getting, most of them are now really stringently urging people to turn on at least some basic encryption. But there's still plenty of people that they just turn on their wireless, they don't want to have to put in an encryption key or a password, and so they're running unencrypted. Well, let me give you a little bit of an idea of why you want to turn on that encryption. First of all, if you don't have the encryption on, you're basically telling anybody with a wireless laptop, card, handheld, whatever, that you're sharing your internet connection freely and gladly. And most of the time, that won't really hurt you. A lot of people are just passing by and they need a connection, check their email or whatever. But you never know when it's some little script kiddie. A script kiddie is somebody who is a wannabe hacker, doesn't really understand what they're doing, but they download programs that are made by hackers and then use them to attack people, and they think they're really cool and powerful, and they're so elite. and unfortunately, the 99% of the quote unquote hackers out there are script kiddies, and then there's a very small percentage who actually know what they're doing. So that's a lot of mass numbers of troublemakers out there. So they drive around and do what's known as war driving, and war driving comes from an old term in the BBS and phone days of war dialing. Word dialing is where you pick an exchange number and set up your software to start dialing to find a connection. In fact, in the old 81 movie War Games, there's a perfect example where the kid sets up his computer to dial 539.1000 through 1999. and find which ones respond. If it's a human, it gets marked off the list. If it's a fax machine, okay, it's a fax. If it's a computer, oh, put that in the list for later. And then later they go back and try to crack into the computer systems. And so that was called war dialing. It's you're brute forcing your way to find computers that are on the dial-up systems. This is before the internet was really mainstream. And so war driving is driving around trying to find wireless networks to hop onto. And if you don't have your network encryption turned on, then anybody can hop on anytime they want as long as they're in range of your house. And typically you can get within a few hundred feet of a house, unless you're down in a basement or something with your access point. You can pick up the signal 20, 30, 100, 200 feet away very usably. So you can have somebody out on the street or a few houses down using your internet connection. You'd never know about it. And using your internet connection, that's not a big deal. San Francisco and the Bay Area, they have a whole free net community there where people are intentionally sharing their networks so that as you drive around, you can stay connected, or as you walk around the parks, whatever, you can be connected. These people are freely sharing that. But you have other people who aren't meaning to do that, and they'd really rather not have anybody on there. And then you have the people who get on there who are computer criminals, script kiddies, hackers, whatever you want to call them. And they will not only use your connection to attack people and then you get blamed, or use your connection for peer-to-peer file sharing. See, I'm coming back around to making a point there. And they will attack your systems too. They will scan your system for any vulnerabilities. If it's Windows, it'll have all sorts of ports open. They'll access your files. They'll install Trojans, keystroke loggers, so they'll get all your passwords, your financial data, all the websites you go to, etc. If you are running on a wireless network without encryption, you're wide open. And I can't stress it enough, because I drive around all the time, and I'm not war driving, but I have a little handheld that's like a miniature laptop that I set up there on the dash of my car. And I see all these networks pass through, and it shows which ones are encrypted and which ones aren't. And 90% of them are not encrypted. Whether it's downtown Spokane or in the county areas, it doesn't seem to matter. People are just not turning on their encryption. And it's not that hard. Every access point in the last few years makes it really easy. If you're running Windows, Mac, or Linux, they make it really easy to type in a basic encryption key. It doesn't have to be much, but something's better than nothing. If for no other reason, then it's like putting maybe a fence around your yard or a lock on your door, or even just a sign that says no trespassing. At least you're saying, hey, listen, here's my wireless network. I'd rather you stay off it. And the reason why I say it that way is because, unfortunately, the wireless encryption is hackable. It's crackable. And the early versions of it, WEP, W-E-P, is supposed to be Wired Equivalency Protocol, was really pitiful. You could stick a handheld or laptop computer within a wireless network, and you'd had to catch about, I think it was 1.5 million packets, which doesn't take very long on an active network, a few hours to a day or two, and you'd have the key completely cracked. And then everything is clear and open text. Newer versions, WPA and PSK and these other versions that have come out, they take a little bit longer to crack. And basically, the way it is now is if you have your encryption on, since your next-door neighbor doesn't have it on, well, it's the same thing like having your door locked or unlocked, or a car alarm, or not having a car alarm, leaving your car locked or unlocked. Criminals are inherently lazy. And if there's some easier bait right next door, they're just going to go over there instead of messing with you. So just turn on your encryption on your wireless access point. And again, you just look at your owner manual to do that. So that's something I'm just trying to get out there, because I've seen so many people. It's amazing. And then they wonder how they get these viruses and worms and spyware and adware and malware, or even these people who get sued for peer-to-peer file sharing when they never did it. Well, it's because they're sharing their network with anybody who wants to get on their network. So please, please encrypt your wireless network. I hope you find that useful. I'm here in the studio if you have any questions at 509-747-3807. I'm going to start switching back to the normal synthetic Zen show formatting to get caught up on some PSAs and show promos, etc. I hope you're finding this information useful. And again, I'm hoping in the near future to have a one-hour show dedicated to this topic of technology and how it affects civil rights, how it affects your privacy, your security, open source alternatives, etc. This has just been another example of a typical show. I hope down the road to be able to take caller questions. I probably won't be able to do it live on the air since we don't have a call screener or a time delay, but you can call in and ask questions, and then I can